Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. Funny thing about being fast, you end up waiting a lot. First to show up, first in line, then just waiting. Me, I rev up Chumba Casino. With over 200 social casino games, no slow lanes here. Why sit around when you can spin? I'm already racing. Your turn. Play for free at ChumbaCasino.com. That's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi there, my name's Andy.
And my name's Anna.
And we are two of the four hosts of the podcast No Such Thing as a Fish. We present every week the most amazing, wonderful, insane, hilarious, bizarre facts you've ever heard.
Facts like, did you know America has a national grocery bag packing competition?
Did you know, Anna, the company Volkswagen sells more sausages than it does cars?
Yes, we've got those two facts and about a billion more in our podcast archives for you to listen to. We chat about them, we laugh about them, we make the occasional terrible pun.
It's great fun. It's called No Such Thing as a Fish. Why don't you listen now? Hi there, my name's Andy.
And my name's Anna.
And we are two of the four hosts of the podcast No Such Thing as a Fish. We present every week the most amazing, wonderful, insane, hilarious, bizarre facts you've ever heard.
Facts like, did you know America has a national grocery bag packing competition?
Did you know, Anna, the company Volkswagen sells more sausages than it does cars?
Yes, we've got those two facts and about a billion more in our podcast archives for you to listen to. We chat about them, we laugh about them, we make the occasional terrible pun.
It's great fun. It's called No Such Thing as a Fish. Why don't you listen now?
This is a true crime in real time update. The latest on the biggest cases we're following at True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Imagine sitting in a quiet, sterile room, the kind that police investigators know all too well, staring at a computer screen filled with ordinary digital clutter, family photos, business emails, and files you'd find on anyone's laptop. Nothing unusual there. Until, out of that everyday mess, you stumble onto something chilling. Something you can't unsee. Something that feels like finding a serial killer's playbook just sitting there, staring back at you. That's exactly what happened in early 2023 when forensic investigators finally accessed the hard drive belonging to Rex Huerman. By now, you've probably heard his name splashed across headlines as the prime suspect in the Gilgo Beach murders, a string of horrifying killings that have haunted Long Island since remains were first discovered over a decade ago. But investigators weren't prepared for what they would uncover deep in Huerman's digital shadows, a carefully constructed, meticulously detailed, alleged manifesto deleted long ago, but now glaring at them in clear, stark text. What exactly was this document, this alleged blueprint of murder? Well, imagine a shopping list crossed with a DIY home renovation guide. But instead of paint colors and lumber, the items listed were ropes, tarps, acid, cutting tools, plastic bags, and cat litter. And instead of casual weekend chores, this DIY guide detailed steps like building a table, presumably not for a friendly dinner party. It's as if Martha Stewart turned malevolent and started writing how-tos for hiding bodies and covering your tracks. Dark, I know, but disturbingly accurate. The document wasn't just a vague sketch or a creepy diary entry. No, it was methodical, almost military in precision, organized into clear stages labeled pre-prep, prep, and post-event. It spelled out exactly what needed to happen before, during, and after the horrifying acts. Each phase contained tasks you might expect from someone trying desperately to leave zero trace behind. It was a roadmap for evading capture, as chillingly detailed as instructions for assembling a piece of IKEA furniture, albeit a far more sinister piece. Let's break it down a bit. The manifesto contained its own coded shorthand, cryptic to outsiders but clearly defined by the author. DS1 and DS2 were not random letters and numbers. They stood for Dump Site 1 and Dump Site 2. These weren't just vague possibilities either. They pointed directly to specific locations, including an eerily accurate mention of Mill Road in Manorville, an isolated stretch of land on Long Island. It's a location where, years later, partial remains of known victims, Jessica Taylor and Valerie Mack, were found. It's unsettling, but it makes you wonder if the person writing this was quietly marking a spot on their macabre treasure map long before authorities ever arrived. Another shorthand entry, T-1, referred explicitly to targets, the victims themselves, human beings reduced to mere labels in this grim outline. Names and details were sparse, but one chilling note stood out clearly. Megan? Followed by a question mark. Investigators were left wondering if this referred directly to Megan Waterman, one of the known Gilgo Beach victims. Or was it just a coincidence? A placeholder of sorts. That's the disturbing part. It's like reading someone's notes, uncertain if you're witnessing their cold method of depersonalizing victims or catching a glimpse of confusion amid monstrous intent. Now, alongside these logistical codes were deeply unsettling checklists, practical measures for forensic countermeasures. This wasn't an amateur's rough sketch. It was an exhaustive list to avoid leaving evidence behind. Imagine the sort of precautions you'd take if you spilled red wine on your mother-in-law's prized carpet and multiply it exponentially. DNA avoidance? Check. The document recommended using booties, those little plastic shoe covers, to avoid leaving footprints or DNA, hairnets to prevent stray hairs from falling, surgical gloves to eliminate fingerprints, and then burning those gloves after use to destroy even the slightest trace of physical evidence. This wasn't casual caution. It was obsessive attention to detail. The steps didn't end there. There were instructions on how to remove identifying marks from victims, tattoos, birthmarks, scars, even fingerprints, and disturbingly practical advice on dismemberment and disposal, tools needed, how to package remains for discreet transport, and even notes about washing the victims to erase trace evidence. It's one thing to imagine such horrors. It's entirely another to realize someone meticulously typed them out on a computer, carefully crafted, and then consciously deleted, thinking no one would ever find them again. Also included were precise steps for surveillance, or recon, as the author called it, scouting locations, checking for security cameras, avoiding high traffic areas, using police scanners to monitor law enforcement chatter. This wasn't just paranoia. It was calculated strategy. Imagine a chess game, except the stakes aren't wooden pieces on a board, but life and death. The author of this document was carefully considering every possible scenario, every conceivable way to get caught, and proactively blocking those avenues. But among all these disturbingly specific tactics, there were terms drawn from criminal profiling literature, phrases such as organized versus disorganized, Stockholm syndrome, and something called sex substitution. Let me unpack those briefly, because these aren't terms the average person throws around casually. Organized versus disorganized refers to how criminals behave. Organized offenders plan meticulously, while disorganized ones act impulsively. Clearly, the writer of this document was striving for complete organization. Stockholm syndrome, a psychological phenomenon where victims bond with their captors, was noted down too, perhaps suggesting the author considered using psychological manipulation to extend control. And sex substitution, as clinical and detached as it sounds, implied methods of sexual assault that avoid leaving trace DNA, a horrifyingly practical consideration from someone intent on escaping justice. The author also made bizarre and troubling notes about maintaining control, suggesting that noise control was essential because sound travels, adding surreal and almost mundane advice like getting enough sleep beforehand, because fatigue could lead to mistakes. Think about that for a moment. Someone concerned enough with their performance that they worried about getting proper rest, like an athlete prepping for a big game, only here the game is unspeakable. One strikingly disturbing reminder in the notes said, "The more you do, the more clues you give." It's almost philosophical if you don't think too deeply about what doing means in this context. Another cryptic suggestion read, "Look at the painting, what, why, who?" Advice seemingly pulled from criminal profiling books indicating an author trying to understand his own motivations or how investigators might analyze him. Imagine a serial killer studying the methods of law enforcement profilers, not to evade them randomly, but to deliberately preempt their investigative techniques. That's the unsettling level of foresight and calculation embedded in this document. It's crucial at this point to remind ourselves why investigators and prosecutors see this alleged manifesto as such a critical piece of the puzzle. Finding a detailed murder guide authored allegedly by the prime suspect in a string of brutal killings isn't just rare, it's practically unheard of. Most killers leave clues unintentionally. They slip up, leave behind hairs, fibers, fingerprints, or tire marks. They make mistakes. But very rarely do they leave behind a literal manual detailing exactly how they intended to avoid those mistakes. Think about what that means for investigators. It's like catching someone holding the murder weapon, fingerprints and all, after they've claimed innocence. This document could serve as a cornerstone piece of evidence, something prosecutors could point to and say, look, he planned this. It wasn't accidental. It wasn't spontaneous. It wasn't a misunderstanding. It was meticulous, cold-blooded intent. What's truly shocking is not just that this document was created, but when. Investigators estimate it was originally written around 2000 or 2001, years before many of the known Gilgo Beach victims went missing or were even discovered. That means whoever wrote this manifesto wasn't simply reflecting on past crimes. They were planning future ones. They had already envisioned in clear and explicit detail acts they were yet to commit. It's chilling to realize the planning was in place long before anyone realized a predator might be lurking. So why delete something so carefully constructed? Perhaps panic, perhaps fear of discovery, or maybe a realization that such explicit planning was too incriminating. The point is, this wasn't some proud trophy displayed openly. It was carefully hidden and erased, suggesting the author fully understood the gravity and guilt associated with its contents. As investigators pored over this document, matching its chillingly specific instructions to known evidence, victims, and crime scenes, they realized they had more than just a digital curiosity. They had what might be the strongest possible link yet in a long, complicated, and horrifying case. But just having a plan on paper doesn't automatically prove guilt, especially in a court of law where evidence must be airtight. And that's where things get even more complicated. Because matching words to reality, intentions to actions, is never as simple as it sounds, but the details, the sheer weight of what's written and what was done, make ignoring this alleged manifesto impossible. So where exactly does this newly revealed document fit into the puzzle investigators have been trying to solve for years? How does something created over two decades ago help unravel one of America's darkest mysteries today? Picture this. You're standing at the back of a crowded press conference, microphones shoved forward, camera shutters clicking like frantic crickets waiting for a district attorney to drop a bombshell. That's exactly what happened on a chilly winter afternoon. In early 2024, when Suffolk County District Attorney Ray Tierney stepped confidently up to the podium, there was tension, curiosity, everyone knowing something big was about to be announced. Then calmly but forcefully, Tierney laid out new murder charges against Rex Huerman. It wasn't just another small update in an endless investigation. This was huge. Two new names, Jessica Taylor and Sandra Castilla, were now officially tied to Huerman, plus Valerie Mack. Suddenly, the Gilgo Beach investigation ballooned, linking murders spread over nearly two decades. But this announcement wasn't just shocking because of the names added. It was shocking because of how closely these new charges aligned with a dark, chilling document allegedly found hidden deep in Huerman's computer. We've already explored what that manifesto said, but now let's look at exactly how its cold, clinical instructions matched what investigators actually found at crime scenes. Piece by meticulous piece, since the manifesto author clearly favored smaller targets, victims who would be easier to overpower, control, and transport, and the grim reality matches perfectly. All of the known victims connected with Rex Huerman, Amber Lynn Costello, Melissa Barthelemy, Megan Waterman, Maureen Brainerd Barnes, Jessica Taylor, Sandra Castilla, and Valerie Mack, fit a disturbingly similar physical profile. Petite young women, most barely taller than 5 feet. It's not coincidence or guesswork. It's the exact victim profile described explicitly in the alleged notes. Even more unsettlingly precise was the instruction to remove identifying marks from victims' bodies. The author wrote plainly about eliminating tattoos, birthmarks, and scars, any feature that could quickly identify who the victim was. And tragically, this matches the state in which Jessica Taylor's remains were discovered back in 2003. Her killer didn't just dismember her, he deliberately mutilated a distinctive tattoo on her body, attempting to literally erase who she was. This kind of detail doesn't just happen by chance or panic. It happens when someone is deliberately following a methodical playbook. Valerie Mack, too, was treated with similarly calculated brutality. Her remains, found in two separate locations years apart, were carefully dismembered, head and hands removed to conceal her identity. It's exactly what the manifesto prescribed: removal of hands and head to eliminate fingerprints, dental records, and facial recognition. The echoes here are horrifyingly precise, down to the exact steps listed. Remove, dismember, discard. It's as if the author was following a recipe, each victim becoming a grim ingredient in a monstrous plan. But it's not just the handling of victims themselves that aligns so disturbingly with the manifesto. It's also the actual physical evidence investigators uncovered at Rex Huerman's home. After carefully following the roadmap laid out in the alleged notes, remember the instructions we talked about earlier? Specific advice to hang plastic drop cloths from the ceiling using push pins rather than tape, presumably to avoid noise or sticky residue? Investigators following these clues returned to Huerman's basement with forensic precision, examining walls and ceilings with specialized infrared equipment. What they found were tiny pinholes punctuating the ceiling. The unmistakable marks left behind by pins, exactly as the manifesto described. It's the kind of detail you'd only find if someone was meticulously following their own gruesome instructions, not simply improvising. And let's talk about DNA, or rather, the stunning lack of it. Serial killers often leave behind inadvertent clues, hair strands, skin cells, fingerprints. Yet in many of the Gilgo Beach cases, investigators noted an almost baffling absence of clear, identifiable DNA from the perpetrator. The manifesto, of course, provided explicit instructions for precisely how to avoid leaving any DNA behind. Wear hairnets, medical gloves, and disposable booties. Wash victims thoroughly before disposal. Burn gloves after use. Investigators have acknowledged that the sparse forensic evidence from these crime scenes matches the manifesto's detailed instructions for avoiding detection. It's almost like the author anticipated every forensic method detectives would use and actively countered them. Another disturbing alignment involves vehicle and tire tracks, or notably, the lack of distinctive tire tracks at the crime scenes. Investigators knew early on that the killer likely used a vehicle for transport, yet they struggled to identify clear tire impressions or distinctive markings. Then came the discovery of notes in the manifesto urging caution with vehicles, advising to change tires frequently to avoid leaving consistent tracks. And indeed, during their investigation, detectives discovered that Huerman had multiple vehicles registered to him, including two nearly identical Chevrolet Avalanche trucks purchased at separate times. It fits precisely with someone deliberately swapping vehicles or tires to confuse investigators, another piece of advice spelled out in chilling detail. Now, perhaps the clearest and most haunting alignment of all is tied directly to a location mentioned explicitly in the manifesto, Mill Road in Manorville. This wasn't some random guess scribbled down. It was deliberately highlighted as a dump site labeled clearly as DS1. And years after this document was supposedly written, the partial remains of Jessica Taylor and Valerie Mack were indeed discovered near Mill Road. Let that sink in. A location identified by the manifesto author nearly two decades ago turned out to be exactly where victims' remains were later found. It's hard to dismiss such an explicit connection as mere coincidence or random luck, especially given the detailed care behind the rest of the notes. Yet even with all these eerie connections, it's crucial to remain grounded in the facts. Investigators carefully documented each alignment, each subtle but precise echo between the words on the computer screen and real-world crime scenes. They meticulously cataloged physical evidence at Huerman's home. Pinholes from pushpins in the basement, signs of structural alterations, and carefully cleaned surfaces as though someone had followed instructions to the letter. No speculation or guesswork, just painstaking forensic diligence. And it's this meticulous alignment between plan and reality, between the alleged manifesto and actual crimes, that gives prosecutors their strongest circumstantial evidence. Imagine trying to claim innocence when the details of your supposed fictional notes keep turning up again and again at real-world crime scenes. It's the equivalent of finding someone's secret recipe book, then discovering every ingredient from that recipe used exactly at the scene of multiple crimes. Coincidence only goes so far. Eventually, patterns become undeniable. As prosecutors build their case against Rex Huerman, this meticulous alignment between instructions and evidence isn't simply a minor detail. It's foundational. The lack of perpetrator DNA aligns exactly with methods explicitly detailed to prevent it. The dismemberments and mutilations mirror the step-by-step instructions written years before the crimes were even discovered. Even something as seemingly trivial as tiny pinholes in a basement ceiling offers a stark, chilling parallel. Another dot connected in a horrifying constellation of evidence. When District Attorney Ray Tierney stood in front of that crowded room announcing new charges against Huerman, he wasn't merely presenting disconnected allegations. Instead, he laid out an intricate tapestry of evidence, carefully woven threads connecting words written in secret to brutal crimes committed in darkness. These weren't casual similarities. They were disturbingly precise matches. Each one carefully documented, each one methodically investigated. But here's the tricky thing about circumstantial evidence. Even when it aligns this tightly, it's still not a direct confession or DNA match. It doesn't speak for itself. It has to be explained, interpreted, and argued in court. Prosecutors must convince a jury not just of the eerie alignments themselves, but of what these alignments undeniably imply. They must carefully unpack how precisely and deliberately reality matched the alleged manifesto, showing not just random chance, but meticulous, calculated planning that could only belong to someone directly involved. Which naturally leads us to the question, how exactly will prosecutors leverage this disturbing alignment between the manifesto and real-world evidence in court? How will they navigate the complex legal challenges of turning a haunting but circumstantial roadmap into undeniable proof of guilt? Imagine yourself in a courtroom, not the kind you've seen on TV, filled with dramatic lawyers pounding fists and witnesses breaking down under pressure, but a real one, quiet, tense, filled mostly with silent anticipation. Lawyers, investigators, jurors, all waiting to hear one thing: proof. Hard, convincing evidence that the person sitting at the defendant's table is undeniably responsible for terrible acts. In a case like the one against Rex Huerman, it's not enough to present a disturbing story or suspicious coincidences. Prosecutors have to show beyond any reasonable doubt not just that crimes were committed, but that this specific person planned them, executed them, and knew exactly what he was doing every step of the way. And that's where the alleged manifesto comes in. When Suffolk County District Attorney Ray Tierney first described this disturbing document publicly, he referred to it as more than just a creepy digital find. It was critical evidence, tangible proof of premeditation. Premeditation is a fancy legal word, but at its core, it means someone thought about a crime before committing it. Not just briefly, but deliberately, in detail, and with clear intent. Think of it this way. The difference between an impulsive decision and carefully writing out a plan is vast in a courtroom. And here prosecutors believe they found precisely that, a premeditated roadmap. But prosecutors have to tread carefully. Introducing evidence like this manifesto isn't as simple as tossing it onto a table and saying, "Here, look at how bad this looks." Legally, they have to demonstrate why this specific piece of evidence is critical, why it should be shown to a jury, why it helps prove guilt rather than just inflame emotions. You see, evidence in court must always pass the test of being more probative than prejudicial. That means its value for proving guilt has to outweigh any potential bias or unfair prejudice it might cause. Lawyers often fight fiercely over this issue, and you can bet Huerman's defense team will argue aggressively that this alleged manifesto is too prejudicial, that it will unfairly inflame jurors against their client. But the prosecution has a solid, straightforward argument. Yes, this manifesto is disturbing, but it's disturbing precisely because it aligns with what actually happened. It's not just a random graphic fantasy or fictional narrative. It's a document that matches real-world evidence and actions. Prosecutors will emphasize how it provides essential context, a clear demonstration of specific intent. The fact that someone thought these horrific acts through methodically outlined steps meticulously and then took deliberate actions to hide the evidence of wrongdoing. Another significant legal point prosecutors can emphasize is what lawyers call consciousness of guilt. The idea is simple. Innocent people generally don't go out of their way to hide or destroy evidence. If you've done nothing wrong, you typically don't feel compelled to erase every trace of your actions or delete detailed documents about committing crimes. Here, the prosecution will point out something very important. The manifesto itself wasn't found in an easily accessible place. It had been deliberately deleted from Huerman's hard drive. It existed only as fragments of data recovered painstakingly by digital forensic specialists. This deletion, prosecutors will argue, wasn't accidental. It was deliberate, careful, and calculated. It demonstrated awareness, clear knowledge that this document was incriminating and that it must never see the light of day. But prosecutors face another challenge. How exactly do you connect this single piece of evidence to multiple separate crimes spanning nearly two decades? This isn't just one murder trial. It's several murders, each happening years apart, different victims, different locations. The manifesto, though, offers prosecutors a critical tool, legal leverage to tie all these separate murders together under one defendant. They'll argue that the document's existence and the specific steps described in it illustrate a clear modus operandi, a distinctive way of operating that binds multiple crimes together. It's the courtroom equivalent of finding a single fingerprint across multiple crime scenes. Jurors must understand why these crimes aren't random or separate, but rather systematically connected by a precise, detailed plan laid out years before the crimes took place. Yet despite all this compelling circumstantial evidence, prosecutors know that jurors might still need help connecting the dots. The manifesto's details, while chilling, can also feel confusing, clinical, and even detached. Jurors aren't experts in criminal behavior, forensic methods, or criminal psychology. That's why, at this point in the trial, prosecutors often bring in expert witnesses to explain complex matters clearly and objectively. Criminal profiling experts, forensic psychologists, or experienced investigators can play a vital role here. These professionals won't speculate or guess. Instead, they'll carefully explain terms found within the manifesto, like organized versus disorganized offenders, which refers directly to how meticulously planned crimes indicate deliberate and intentional behavior. They'll unpack concepts like sex substitution, describing objectively what it means as a tactic of sexual violence that deliberately avoids leaving behind incriminating DNA evidence. Experts might also help jurors grasp terms like Stockholm syndrome, explaining it clinically, without speculation, to demonstrate the degree to which the author of this manifesto was considering psychological manipulation and control as part of his alleged plan. Such testimony isn't sensationalized drama. It's straightforward clarification. Jurors need context to understand exactly why this manifesto is significant. It's like when you take your car to a mechanic, someone knowledgeable who can clearly explain what the strange sound or blinking dashboard light means without making guesses. Similarly, these criminal profiling experts serve as neutral guides, walking the jury through complex concepts, clarifying facts without assumptions, and ensuring the manifesto's importance is clearly understood. And these experts can highlight another key aspect, adaptability. The manifesto suggests an offender who learned and adjusted tactics, not repeating mistakes, evolving methods to avoid detection. This isn't speculation. It's objectively evident from the document itself, which explicitly notes ways to avoid leaving behind forensic clues, instructions to change routines and equipment to prevent capture, and even advice on getting adequate rest to avoid mistakes. Again, prosecutors will rely on experts not to guess, but to clearly illustrate what these written instructions objectively indicate about the mindset and intent of the manifesto's author. This expert testimony also provides an important framework for prosecutors to reinforce their narrative about Rex Huerman. It moves the prosecution's case from abstract concepts into something tangible, understandable, and concrete. It helps jurors see clearly how the dots connect, not just within one case, but across multiple murders spanning decades. It helps jurors see exactly why the prosecution argues that only someone intimately familiar with these crimes could have created such a chillingly accurate document. But the manifesto's impact doesn't stop at the courtroom door. Investigators, upon discovering the document, immediately recognized its potential as a roadmap for further investigative steps. In early 2024, detectives used details from the manifesto as a literal guidebook for conducting follow-up searches at Huerman's home and other associated locations. These searches weren't random. They were methodically planned based explicitly on insights from the recovered notes. Forensic teams revisited areas specifically mentioned in the manifesto, such as the basement ceiling with pinhole evidence of pushpins. They re-examined storage spaces, flooring, and even drainage systems mentioned in the document, searching for physical corroboration of the instructions outlined in this digital blueprint. This careful and targeted reinvestigation illustrates another essential role the manifesto has played. It's given prosecutors and detectives fresh avenues to pursue tangible evidence. Not speculation, but specific, verifiable locations and steps that could yield physical proof. It turned what could have been a confusing or daunting search into something focused, actionable, and incredibly valuable. Ultimately, the manifesto's greatest legal strength lies precisely in this fact-based clarity. It isn't vague. It isn't abstract. It's meticulously detailed, objectively aligning with documented physical evidence and providing prosecutors with specific, concrete tools to argue guilt convincingly in court. It's a document so precise, so clear in its details and implications, that jurors who must remain objective and unbiased will find it nearly impossible to dismiss as coincidence or casual fiction. As this case moves toward trial, prosecutors know they have an extraordinary piece of evidence at their disposal, one that doesn't simply suggest guilt, but actively demonstrates planning, intent, and deliberate attempts to avoid capture. It gives them a clear narrative, powerful leverage, and substantial legal tools to secure justice. But courtroom battles are always unpredictable, especially in complex cases involving serial murder and intricate forensic evidence. The manifesto isn't a magic bullet. It's a tool that must be skillfully used, carefully argued, and compellingly presented. Prosecutors must convince a jury of ordinary citizens, people just like you and me, that this deeply disturbing document isn't just horrifying fiction, but an undeniable glimpse into a carefully concealed criminal reality. And when they step into that courtroom, they'll lean heavily on this evidence, knowing its rare power to transform complexity into clarity, knowing it might just be their strongest chance at finally delivering justice.
In a world where the darkest secrets lie just beneath the surface.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence says otherwise.
Where hidden killers roam unnoticed in the shadows.
I think you would definitely be looking at a blend of toxic, very bad narcissistic personality traits, and they will be vengeful and possibly resort to violence.
Join Tony Bruschi as he uncovers the truth behind the most chilling cases.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence clearly says otherwise.
Each episode, we dig deep into the minds of those who commit the unthinkable.
To your point on narcissism, he thinks in his own mind how witty he is.
Yeah.
But he lost that jury. I was done with him in 2 minutes.
From unsolved mysteries to infamous crimes.
Geez, you've just talked about how you've taught yourself how to do everything under the sun. I bet you did a YouTube video, How to Best Kill Somebody with a Knife.
Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi takes you where few dare to go.
How does someone with such a dark secret go unnoticed for so long?
With multiple new episodes every single day.
We're not just telling stories, we're seeking justice.
Listen now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
Hi there, my name's Andy.
And my name's Anna.
And we are two of the four hosts of the podcast No Such Thing as a Fish. We present every week the most amazing, wonderful, insane, hilarious, bizarre facts you've ever heard.
Facts like, did you know America has a national grocery bag packing competition?
Did you know, Anna, the company Volkswagen sells more sausages than it does cars?
Yes, we've got those two facts and about a billion more in our podcast archives for you to listen to. We chat about them, we laugh about them, we make the occasional terrible pun.
It's great fun. It's called No Such Thing as a Fish. Why don't you listen now?
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper? A woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver. If you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. Choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus terms and conditions apply.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores, like Target, Nike, and Instacart. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. It's easy to use, and you can get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten, Rakuten.com.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi there, my name's Andy.
And my name's Anna.
And we are two of the four hosts of the podcast No Such Thing as a Fish. We present every week the most amazing, wonderful, insane, hilarious, bizarre facts you've ever heard.
Facts like, did you know America has a national grocery bag packing competition?
Did you know, Anna, the company Volkswagen sells more sausages than it does cars?
Yes, we've got those two facts and about a billion more in our podcast archives for you to listen to. We chat about them, we laugh about them, we make the occasional terrible pun.
It's great fun. It's called No Such Thing as a Fish. Why don't you listen now?
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woohoo!
Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21
Hi there, my name's Andy.
And my name's Anna.
And we are two of the four hosts of the podcast No Such Thing as a Fish. We present every week the most amazing, wonderful, insane, hilarious, bizarre facts you've ever heard.
Facts like, did you know America has a national grocery bag packing competition?
Did you know, Anna, the company Volkswagen sells more sausages than it does cars?
Yes, we've got those two facts and about a billion more in our podcast archives for you to listen to. We chat about them, we laugh about them, we make the occasional terrible pun.
It's great fun. It's called No Such Thing as a Fish. Why don't you listen now?
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi there, my name's Andy.
And my name's Anna.
And we are two of the four hosts of the podcast No Such Thing as a Fish. We present every week the most amazing, wonderful, insane, hilarious, bizarre facts you've ever heard.
Facts like, did you know America has a national grocery bag packing competition?
Did you know, Anna, the company Volkswagen sells more sausages than it does cars?
Yes, we've got those two facts and about a billion more in our podcast archives for you to listen to. We chat about them, we laugh about them, we make the occasional terrible pun.
It's great fun. It's called No Such Thing as a Fish. Why don't you listen now?
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest. Life comes at you fast, which is why it's important to find some time to relax. A little you time. Enter Chumba Casino. With no download required, you can jump on anytime, anywhere for the chance to redeem some serious prizes. So treat yourself with Chumba Casino and play over 100 online casino-style games, all for free. Go to ChumbaCasino.com to collect your free welcome bonus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi there, my name's Andy.
And my name's Anna.
And we are two of the four hosts of the podcast No Such Thing as a Fish. We present every week the most amazing, wonderful, insane, hilarious, bizarre facts you've ever heard.
Facts like, did you know America has a national grocery bag packing competition?
Did you know, Anna, the company Volkswagen sells more sausages than it does cars?
Yes, we've got those two facts and about a billion more in our podcast archives for you to listen to. We chat about them, we laugh about them, we make the occasional terrible pun.
It's great fun. It's called No Such Thing as a Fish. Why don't you listen now? Hi there, my name's Andy.
And my name's Anna.
And we are two of the four hosts of the podcast No Such Thing as a Fish. We present every week the most amazing, wonderful, insane, hilarious, bizarre facts you've ever heard.
Facts like, did you know America has a national grocery bag packing competition?
Did you know, Anna, the company Volkswagen sells more sausages than it does cars?
Yes, we've got those two facts and about a billion more in our podcast archives for you to listen to. We chat about them, we laugh about them, we make the occasional terrible pun.
It's great fun. It's called No Such Thing as a Fish. Why don't you listen now?